You're very welcome to the Firm and Fast Golf Podcast. I'm your host, Shane Darby. This is the second episode of our DocuPod series on golf in the Netherlands. Returning listeners will remember that in the last episode, we introduced the series and indeed Dutch golf. We heard from Mike Clayton on how the best golf courses in Holland match up to the very best elsewhere. George Waters reminded us of the advantages that sandy sites afford designers, green staff and golfers alike. While Frank Pont gave us an elevator pitch on golf in the Low Countries, in addition to introducing us to the delights of the Lynx Valley Golf Club in Ermelo, the east of the Netherlands. We also briefly touched upon the specific habitats that the 250 golf courses in the Netherlands inhabit. Today's episode is going to focus specifically on these grounds for golf and consider what forces, processes, and influences created them through time. What are they and where are they located? And indeed their maintenance and additional functionality. It will be necessary to connect a multitude of threads across a number of diverse but related subject matters, namely geography, geology, history, and a smidgen of sociology thrown in for good measure. The hope is that by teasing out these threads, it will be possible to gain a better appreciation of how the landscape of modern-day Holland was created, ultimately leading to golf in the dunes, upon the heathland, and across the lowlands known as the Polderland. Now, I'm obviously no geologist, or indeed historian for that matter. Therefore, you will be pleased to hear that assistance for this episode in these areas has been provided to us by Robert Hack and Robin Bergman. Robin is widely recognised as one of the leading Dutch golf scholars with a broad range of research interests, including early Dutch golf. He has been a member of the Kennemer Golf and Country Club in Zandvoort for many years, and makes a cameo appearance towards the end of the episode in advance of being our main focus in episode 3. Robert Hack will be today's main contributor. Robert is a golfing geologist who for many years plied his professional trade in the copper mines of South America and Africa for mining companies such as Anglo-American and Zambian Consolidated. He now operates his own geological consulting business, Bonzo Consulting, from his base in Leiden, South Holland. Robert's a member at both Noordwijk and Rijswijk golf clubs. Over the course of future episodes, and with the help of various contributors, we will focus more on some of the history and origin stories of specific Dutch golf clubs. However, by way of introduction, Noordwijk is the last of the true Dutch links courses to be built at the start of the 1970s, laid out on and above what is known as a beach terrace or beach wall. Rijswijk, on the other hand, is the antithesis of Noordwijk, a more modern Donald Steele creation from the 1980s, laid out on inland Polderland. Robert will provide ongoing commentary as we progress through this episode. As a starting point, I received some online feedback in conjunction with releasing the last episode in this series, and a reply from @personified has provided us with a good starting point for today's deliberations on the origin story of the grounds for golf in the Netherlands. His tweet reads as follows. I'm surprised that there are 100-acre patches of land that aren't muddy soup all year round. That comment obviously is in relation to the landscape of the Netherlands. Notwithstanding the aforementioned, you will not be surprised that water in its various forms has been the main contributory factor in the creation of the landmass that we know as the Netherlands. Specifically, maritime, riverine, glacial and underlying water table influences. The supporting act also includes wind, climate change and the ingenuity of the hand of man directed towards drainage and land reclamation. Our anchor point from a geological perspective is the Pleistocene, which is more commonly known as the Ice Age. This first began in the region of 2.6 million years ago. Interestingly, the Pleistocene should actually be considered as the Ice Ages, as it was in fact made up of an alternating series of up to 17 glacial and interglacial periods, where glaciers advanced and retreated across Europe. Perhaps unsurprisingly, what we know of as the Netherlands today would have been completely unrecognizable from what existed back then.
If you look at the geology of the Netherlands, then basically we are a deposit of the large rivers. One very large river is already gone for a few hundred thousand years. That's the Eridanos, which was a river coming from northern Russia right to the North Sea, with the size at the North Sea, something like the Amazon, must have been an enormous river. And a lot of the deeper sediments in the Netherlands come from this Eridanos river, sands and also clay deposits. But also the Rhine and the Meuse are adding quite a lot of sediment, and the Schelde is adding a lot of sediment. And for some of them, also the rivers from the UK. They're on the other side of the North Sea, but at times there was enough wind over the North Sea to blow some of the sand from the UK side up to the Dutch coast. In the time of the glaciations, the Ice Ages, as it's commonly known, the North Sea was dry, and at that time you could have wind blasting sand all over the place. So in the Pleistocene 100,000 years ago, during the last ice age, you had the first humans walking around there. It was one large sand deposit with grass growing on it from here to the UK, and most of the southern North Sea was completely dry. Then after that, you had the ice in the northern part of the North Sea, and past the northern part, past the ice, there was some ocean again. When the glaciations were over and the temperature started increasing, the ice melted away. The North Sea started to become fuller with water. The first coastlines for the Netherlands are way into the North Sea, not at the present location, but way in the direction of the UK. But that's taken some 8,000-10,000 years to get the water level in the North Sea as high as it is more or less at present.
Much of what is now known as the Netherlands was created during the Salian glaciation period, between 180,000 and 130,000 years ago. In the central Netherlands, push moraines of up to 100 metres above mean sea level were deposited. Vast amounts of glacial material were also laid down in the north of the country. In the south, the influence of the major rivers was dominant, and here the Rhine and the Meuse laid down thick layers of sand and gravel. The final period of glaciation in northern Europe occurred from 65,000 years ago to the beginning of what is known as the Holocene, some 10,000 years ago. During this period, the ice cap did not reach the Netherlands. However, at this time, the land did not support any significant amount of vegetation. In effect, the landscape resembled a polar desert, and significant amounts of cover sand were laid down as a result of wind action. Today's geological journey commences on the North Sea coast as we go in search of an abundance of sand. In the last episode, we heard from George Waters of the advantages the sandy sites represent from a golfing perspective. The three areas that we will explore today are the North Sea dunescape, the inland beach walls, and the inland dunes, ridges, and sand drifts. The first two are derived from maritime influences, with the third being related to glaciation and subsequent transportation by wind action with a little helping hand from mankind. Anyone who has ever peered out of an aircraft window on final easterly approach into Schiphol Airport, or indeed spied the surrounding terrain of the Formula One track at Zandvoort, will not be surprised to hear that 254 kilometres of the North Sea coast of Holland is characterised as barrier dune system. When we explore the coastline of the Netherlands, immediately after the last ice age, some 10,000 years ago, it's a different story altogether. The North Sea coastline of Holland has only been recognisable as such for the last 5,000 years. Prior to that, flux and fluctuation are in evidence from a coastal perspective, as young dunes are formed.
Sometimes the seawater level in the North Sea was likely higher than the land in the Netherlands, and some of these beach walls are actually inside the country. They are now behind the Noordwijk coastline. For example, the Kennemer is on a beach wall rather than on dunes. And that's a beach wall which became dry, not a beach anymore, some 4,000 or 5,000 years ago.
A beach ridge is a wave-swept or wave-deposited ridge running parallel to shoreline. It's commonly composed of sand as well as sediment worked from underlying beach material. A fall in water level, or indeed an uplift of land, can isolate a beach ridge from the body of water that created it. Beach ridges often become routes for roads and trails, like in the case of the West Coast in the Netherlands, where isolated beach ridges were formed behind newly formed dunes. Both the old and the new beach ridges were the only dry routes in the midst of wet peatland. Numerous settlements emerged here, some of them developing into the large population centres such as The Hague, Haarlem and Alkmaar. The last of these beach walls was formed during medieval times. This particular one is now home to the Noordwijk Golf Club. Robert can share some more information on the creation of this dunescape that rises over 25 to 30 metres as you move in an easterly direction away from the coastline.
The last beach wall is the wall, one on which you have Noordwijk and Noordwijk Golf Course. And that has developed into a real full dune set. And why is that? It's likely due to a change in the way that the Rhine came into the sea. Originally, the Rhine passed Leiden, and that moved in just before or during the early medieval times from Katwijk down to some 50, 60 kilometers down to the locations where it's now, it's in Zeeland now. But at that time, in the early medieval times, it was around Katwijk, nearby Noordwijk. That change in water supply to the North Sea changed also the erosion patterns in the North Sea. And a lot of sand in the North Sea, which was there due to the ice ages and wind blown mainly from the UK, was washed away and became the new beaches on the last beach wall where Noordwijk Golf Course is. And that was washed up and wind-blown into this strand barrier and started to form real dunes. And therefore you have these very high dunes where Noordwijk is, 20 meters, sometimes 30 meters even. And that's the result of a relatively young sedimentation pattern, mainly by wind and sea action from the North Sea. And that's only in a barrier of some 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers from the beach.
Having now established the existence of the extensive coastal duneland landscape of the Netherlands, I thought it might be interesting to explore its designation as a large nature reserve, the role the dunes play as a major source of drinking water supply, and how the barrier dune's protective function is maintained and underpinned by an ingenious engineering solution. So in terms of the Dunescape being a large nature reserve, our first port of call is a Europe-wide environmental policy entitled Nature 2000. In May 1992, the governments of the European communities adopted legislation designed to protect the most seriously threatened habitats and species across Europe. This included most of the virginal dunescape where Lynx golf courses are located. Where a golf course was already in existence, a red line was used to mark the boundary between golf and other areas. As a result of this EU-wide legislation, we are likely to have already seen the development of the last great Lynx course within the EU. While not completely impossible in theory, the difficulties of obtaining permissions on these special areas of conservation are extensive. This Habitats Directive complemented a Birds Directive adopted in 1979. Together, they make up the Nature 2000 network of protected areas. As a member state, the Netherlands is a signatory to the Habitats Directive. Interestingly, one of the Lynx courses in the Netherlands finds themselves marooned inside a special area of conservation without the benefit of their own red line protection. Robert can tell us more about this interesting story.
Then we come to another feature of Noordwijk, as I think probably the only course in the Netherlands which is in an actual Nature 2000 area. And Noordwijk Golf Course is right in the middle of that and is not excluded. So everything in Noordwijk Golf Course area has to be done according to the laws and regulations for Nature 2000 areas, which are extremely strict and difficult actually to follow. And in that sense, Noordwijk is completely different from the Kennemer and from the Haagse golf courses, because those two have very intelligent asked for exclusion at the time they started these Nature 2000 areas. Noordwijk did not. So Noordwijk is now right in the middle of it. Every piece of grass is Nature 2000. But Kennemer and the Haagse, they can basically do whatever they like within their areas, for the time being anyhow.
An interesting aside is an additional role that the North Sea Dunescape fulfills. It is as the source of drinking water for large parts of the north and south of Holland. The supply of potable water for these areas is cleaned and filtered in the sand dunes along the Dutch coast. The practice of using the dunes as a source of fresh water started in 1874. A new solution to the growing problem of hygiene was required, as evidenced by a series of cholera epidemics which had broken out throughout Europe over the previous decades. The Meijendel is a 2,000 hectare nature reserve just 5 kilometres from The Hague city centre. And it is here where city authorities first began pumping fresh groundwater. It is actually located right beside the Royal Hague Golf and Country Club. By the 1940s, the city authorities had a new problem on their hands. When too much fresh water is removed, salty, brackish water rises up, leading to salt in the groundwater reservoir. Robert can provide us with a little bit more context here.
The rainwater which falls on the dunes forms a big reservoir floating onto salt water from the North Sea, which is on the deeper levels. And that fresh water in the top part below surface, that is used for drinking water extensively. Amsterdam, The Hague, Leiden, they all use drinking water from there. It's not as much used for agricultural use. Agricultural water, there is enough in the western part generally, and that's supplied by the canals coming from the Rhine or the Meuse. But the drinking water in the dunes is used from the fresh water area, the fresh water volume reservoir below the surface on the dunes, which floats on salt water.
So a responsible balancing act is undoubtedly required by all stakeholders to maintain the freshwater reservoir in the dunes. In addition to replenishment through rainwater, the water authorities also pipe river water from further inland, which is then infiltrated through the dune slacks. This river water sinks through the sand, filters itself from harmful pathogens, and replenishes the underground stocks with clean water. Most water companies across the developed world use chlorine as a disinfectant. By following in nature's footsteps, the water companies of the west of the Netherlands forego chemical disinfectants, supplying The Hague, Haarlem, Amsterdam, and most of the central urban belt with clean, fresh water. The dunescape plays one final key role. To this end, I was interested to ask Robert whether the dunes are also important in terms of flood protection.
Yeah, you're completely correct. Even the place where I live, right on the border of the Old Rhine, that's protected by the dunes in Noordwijk from flooding by the North Sea. The dunes are an essential part of the protection of the west of the Netherlands. Yeah.
A history of flooding and inundation by the sea is a component part of the Dutch experience through the centuries. Various mitigation schemes exist, such as dikes, levees, and flood barriers. However, none are more interesting than engineering focused on dynamic preservation, the aim of which is to protect and nourish the barrier dunes in countering the vagaries of the North Sea and the potential of sea level rise. It's called the Sand Motor, or the Sand Motor in English.
What they also did, and what you mentioned in your email, is the Sand Motor, the Sand Engine. And the Sand Engine is nowadays, now first have to go back to the present situation, they have dredging ships, boats, in the North Sea who pump up sand from the North Sea bottom and flush that onto the beaches, basically along the whole part of the western coast, all the time, every year again, just to maintain the beach as it is at the location, because if you maintain the beach, then you also maintain the dunes behind it. That's quite an quite a lot of work, cost a lot of money as well. And they had the idea that if we make an artificial big hill of sand somewhere, then that sand will automatically be eroded by the North Sea, and the currents will transport that sand all along the Dutch west coast and deposit it again at the locations where it's needed. So that makes a bit more intelligent way of sand suppletion. And that's what's called the Sand Motor near southern part of The Hague. It's working. They're quite happy with it. And it's indeed the sand moves from that sand motor. But the sand motor itself is purely artificial. It's pumped from the North Sea sand and flushed onto that sand motor. But the distribution over the western coast, that goes now basically automatic by the North Sea. That saves money and is probably a better way of maintaining the coastline. You never have too much or not enough sand at the location because the North Sea divides it. So it's quite successful. If it would have been in front of the maybe coming more of these sand supply areas, if one would be established directly before Noordwijk Golf Course, then it may have an influence on the groundwater levels. And that may influence, again, the groundwater levels on the Noordwijk Golf Course as well. But it's not that far at the moment. It's no problem.
Finally, before we move on to the inland sand dunes, a listener suggested that I ask Robert to compare and contrast the formation of the Dutch dunescape with that of the dunescape in Ireland and the UK. Here's what he had to say.
The top layers of sand, they are basically the same, but in the UK, mostly the case is that they are underlain not by sediments, but by rocks or sediments which have been deposited a very, very long time ago. They are not a recent sedimentary environment. Maybe in some of the estuaries you may have golf courses which are on fresh sediments, but I know the golf courses in Northern Ireland, County Down, and the other two I've played there, they were all on the basis of rocks, and the sand dunes were on top of the rocks, so that gives a different mechanism. The sand is blown out of the sea or washed up to the beach, and then the sand takes it up and deposits it on tops of the rocks, and there it forms dunes. Whether the dunes itself are now so much different from the dunes in the Netherlands, which have the same sand, basically, same grain sizes, I think, and that's really very comparable.
So the same and not the same, Mr. Veldkamp. I hope that answered your question. So in our next section, we move on to the inland sandy sites. Those sand dunes, sand ridges, sand drifts, and sand hills that exist in the central and eastern parts of the Netherlands.
The eastern part of the Netherlands stayed dry for most of the time, and in the ice ages or in the glaciation, there was a lot of ice workings, and that pushed up the sand in the hills where you talk about now, the Hees courses, the Pan and Eindhoven. Eindhoven was outside the ice area, so they have sand-blown sand, I think.
So as we've heard, the southern and eastern part of the Netherlands consists mainly of sandy deposits from the last ice age. These deposits are part of the European sand belt, which extends from Britain through the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, Denmark, and Poland up to the Russian border. Riverine deposits from the Rhine and the ancient Eridanus River system were pushed upwards by the advancing ice sheath, forming large hills consisting mainly of sand and gravel. During the final period of the Pleistocene, known as the Weichselian glaciation, periods of extremely cold and dry conditions occurred in the Netherlands. This resulted in the formation of a cold polar desert. Polar winds transported large amounts of sand from this desert, which were redeposited as cover sands. In recent history, man induced large-scale remobilization of these cover sands, further shaped the current locations where these drift sands are located. Some of these sandy deposits will eventually become the sandy forests and drift sands of the Veluwe, Utrecht and Eindhoven, home, of course, to courses such as the Lynx Valley, Utrecht de Pan, and Eindhovense Golf. So we now know where the sand came from. However, the sandy forests that established themselves upon what are known as glacial push moraines were just that, sandy forests. That begs two questions. What is Heathland, and how was it created? So Heathland has actually been shaped by human actions. Beginning at least 5,000 years ago, when humans started clearing trees growing on infertile soils, probably to entice game into clearings to make hunting easier. Later heaths were used to graze livestock. In some areas, layers of charcoal show that the forest was cleared repeatedly by fire for grazing or crops. If undisturbed, heathlands naturally develop back into woodland as trees re-establish themselves and gradually enrich the soils. However, heathlands became part of the farming system, providing grazing for livestock, heather for thatch, turf for fuel, natural fertilizer for agriculture, bracken for bedding and potash, gorse for bread ovens, and livestock fodder, in addition to sand and gravels for building. Severe forest degradation, driven by the production of charcoal from melting iron during the 6th and 7th century, and subsequently the trade in wood from the 11th to the 13th century, resulted in the extension of wind-induced sand drift. Around 1800, at the time of their maximum extent, heathlands in the Netherlands covered over 800,000 hectares. By the end of the 19th century, heathland had lost its economic value due to the introduction of chemical fertilizers. Since then, about 600,000 hectares of heathland have been converted into agricultural land, and 150,000 hectares have been afforested. Our final topic for consideration can best be summed up by René Descartes, the father of modern philosophy. Descartes has been attributed with the following observation: God created the earth, but the Dutch created the Netherlands. So we're going to take a quick look at the precursor to this creation of a type of real estate synonymous with the Low Countries. Suffice to say that as the temperatures in the Netherlands rose in the millennia after the last ice age, conditions were optimal for the establishment and growth of peatlands such as lowland fen and raised bog. Some 3 to 5,000 years ago, the peatlands reached their maximum extent, with 50% of what is considered the Netherlands today being actually peatlands, with approximately 1 million hectares of bogs and 500,000 hectares of lowland fens. Half of the bogs were situated in the coastal plain and half in the eastern and southern Pleistocene sandy areas. Reclamations of these peat bogs started in the 10th century and were so extensive that the period is known as the Big Reclamation. The objective was, of course, to create arable land.
That's really starting at the end of the medieval times, when, in fact, the windmills were invented, and they could start pumping automatically by wind force or wind energy. Then they started indeed pumping out water from low-lying areas, low-lying clay and peat areas. Not that it was actual water before that time. Some people think it was all water, but that is not the case. It were really swampy areas with drier and wetter patches. But if you want to keep cattle on a swampy area, or when you want to grow something on it, the water table, the groundwater table, has to be below the surface and not at about the same level. So that's why they started pumping. But they needed only to pump at that time for some 20, 30 centimeters. And then the water was below surface, and they could use agriculture and have cattle on it.
In the beginning, when the peat surface was still relatively high, digging several ditches was sufficient to create an accessible plot. Over time, as relative surface levels fell, more ingenious solutions were required to better manage water removal and the ongoing maintenance of a workable water table. All of these additional drainage efforts set off a process of peat compaction and a massive oxidation and associated degradation, which continues to this day. This is the reason why the landmass of the Netherlands has sunk. The invention of the windmill in the 15th century facilitated further reclamation of peat areas for agriculture. Collective action saw the formation of the Rijkswaterstaat and the district water boards, who are charged with water management. These federal and municipal authorities are responsible for ensuring a sufficient supply of water and keeping the country protected against flooding. In addition to draining the swamp, much of the peatlands were commercially exploited for fuel, with the cleared landscape being converted to arable land. These companies exploited the peat bogs in a very systematic way. Layers of peat up to 8 meters thick were dug out, followed by the conversion of the denuded areas into agricultural land. In order to be able to penetrate into the peat bogs, drainage was a prerequisite. The area was opened up by canalizing small bog streams, but mostly by digging canals. These canals were also used to transport the peat to the urban markets. Peat is, of course, a product of low value compared to its volume. As a consequence, commercial peat digging was only possible when transportation was done by bulk transport. That's needless to say, by ship.
And there are areas in the western part where they also exploited peat for burning. for heating houses. And that's where the large lakes developed all from, because they excavated the peat. And obviously that was filled by water, and you had a lake as a result, like the Kaag and the West Einde and the whole series of these things. Somewhere in the, I think it's the end of the 18th century, the peat exploitation came to an end, because the lakes started to become so big, they became inland seas, and they became threatening the cities. Like Amsterdam was coming under threat from one of these lakes. So then exploitation was stopped. But yeah, the pumping had to continue for the agriculture on the highlands, and yeah, to maintain the water level below surface.
Today, roughly 26% of the Netherlands is located below mean sea level. It is, of course, here, on these reclaimed expanses, that we find the home of the Polderland golf courses of the Netherlands.
The clay courses, they are a development from starting, well, what shall we say, 70s, somewhere 60s. And before that time, there were not many golf courses in the Netherlands at all. Nowadays, there's a couple of hundred, I believe. But many of these new courses, they are actually on places which you would call a swamp, like Rijswijk would have been a swamp in the medieval times. It's now dry by pumping out the water all the time, and they have a golf course on clay, which is not bad, but it's just good.
We now hopefully have an appreciation for the creation of the specific grounds for golf in the Netherlands. As we conclude this episode, my mind drifts towards the 1890s and the early pioneers of Dutch golf. The question arises as to what sites we utilised initially for the purposes of golf.
In the eastern part of the Netherlands, there you had these sand hills developed from the glaciations. And on that, it was very suitable to build golf courses. Now, why are the golf courses in the western part in the dunes? There was also a second reason, as a social reason. People with money started building houses on the sand beaches. People without money, they could stay in the swamps, basically. And that is a development all since Roman times. You know, that's nothing new. In the times when golf started to develop in the Netherlands, it was very habitual. If you were rich or very rich, then you had a winter home in Amsterdam or The Hague or in Leiden, and a summer home, which was more or less a palace, somewhere on these beach ridges. Not in the swamp, obviously, but on the beach ridges. So you have all the nice houses, the estates, they are on these beach ridges behind the coast in the western part of the Netherlands. Now, the people playing golf in that time were also not really poor people. That were the very rich, actually. And they had their summer homes there, so they wanted to have a golf course nearby. Golf courses in the swamp is not a good idea. So then it started to develop in the dunes to make golf courses, and you get the Kennemer, not on an actual dune, but on a beach barrier. But similar idea, sand underground, Noordwijk, and also the Haagse. And Domburg and Texel, the other two, they are from far later date. They're pretty recent. In the eastern part of the Netherlands, you also have these wonderful houses, the estates from people living in the winter in Utrecht and in the summer somewhere in the woods on the sand grounds and having a nice time. And they obviously built their golf courses nearby on the sand grounds in the eastern part. So that's where you get the East golf courses from.
Today's final reflection once again relates to those aforementioned early pioneers. Robin Bergman, who will be our main contributor for the next Occupied episode, can also provide us with some further insight into those visionaries and early adopters who had the inclination, the connections, and the means to build the first golf courses in the Netherlands.
You see, the beginning of golf, those four golf clubs, that was really the old aristocrats having interrelationships with the English, let's say British, and because of their ties in the Dutch East Indies in the 19th century. And that the Kenmare is in that sense different. The class below that, say the wealthy merchants, said, "Hey, we also want to play golf." And on the estate of Kenmare, this guy who made all this money and on the tobacco business in Sumatra and East Indies, who I explained was the Minister of Colonies and considered the largest, wealthiest man in the Netherlands. So Kenmare started on his estate. His estate was basically the dunes, but he didn't want to give the dunes to us. He could have easily. It's 50 kilometers by 5 kilometers. So it's a large area. You can build 100 golf courses on that without seeing each other. But the Kenmare started with a 9-hole course, which Delcour actually laid out on grassland. And two of the 9 holes were actually just partly on the other side of the road on sand. But the other 7 holes were below the road, below water level, on grassland where normally cows would. So that wasn't that interesting. In retrospect, you know, building a 9-hole golf course in 1910 in the dunes is also impossible because the machinery just didn't exist to build a proper golf course. Well, that probably the Royal St. George's was built, but you need quite large industrial stuff to build a golf course in the dunes, huh? How Royal St. George's did that. But the dunes next to the grassland of the Kenmare are, you know, it's pretty hilly, and you make your golf courses basically in the valley between the dunes. Of course, the war industry developed quite a lot of industrial material to be used on land. But the type of people of the Kenmare were very different.
Many thanks for tuning in. As usual, you can find us online at firmandfast.golf or on Twitter at firmandfastgolf. Please continue to like, subscribe, and comment. It really is appreciated. Until the next time, happy golfing.